Today's K-Show will be on Case 94 in the koan collection known as Entangling Vines. Case 94 is entitled The Avatamsaka Sutra's Simile of the Mind. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is written, "The mind is like an artist, ceaselessly producing the five skandhas. In all the world, there is nothing that is not produced by the mind." I want to thank you all so much for coming to practice Zen. We tend to think about Zen practice, or I tend to talk about Zen practice, in terms of its therapeutic qualities. When I talk about Zen, I often talk about how it makes you feel, or how it makes you feel better. I myself benefit enormously from doing Zazen. When I was just starting out practicing Zen, I would sit down on the cushion and be very distracted or very distressed, very troubled. And after a little bit of sitting, I would feel so much better. I would feel really so much better. I had a lot of trouble sitting. I had a lot of pain in my legs and problems with my back. But nevertheless, when I would sit down on the cushion, I would always get up feeling better. And even if I had not known anything else about Zen, even if I hadn't read a single book on Zen, I think I would have just continued because it just was so therapeutic. But there's another aspect of Zen practice which is a little bit more complicated, you know. It has to do with this question of what are we actually doing when we sit down on a cushion and meditate. You know, so it's possible to say that we're just hypnotizing ourselves or tranquilizing ourselves. If a person was a little bit skeptical about meditation practice, that's what somebody might say. They might just say, "Well, this is just a therapeutic practice. You're tranquilizing yourself. You're hypnotizing yourself, and you feel better, and that's nice." But actually, Buddhism makes a larger claim. Buddhism really says something more about meditation than that. The Buddha did say that this was a path to liberation. But he also said that this was a path to, like, truth. This idea that meditation takes you to truth, to some kind of true insight, it is really very important to Buddhist tradition, very important to Buddhism. So, you know, Buddhism doesn't just say meditation makes you feel better. It says meditation makes you feel better because it frees you from your illusions. It frees you from your illusions. And in our way of thinking, you know, we tend to think, well, there's how you feel and there's what's real. And those two things don't necessarily go together, you know. So if you take a pill, an antidepressant, because you're depressed, you feel better, but you might not think, this is getting me any closer to the truth. At least you just don't feel bad anymore. So, you know, we distinguish between how we feel and what is really real. But the Buddha said, you know, how you feel depends upon whether you're able to get in touch with reality or not. So a lot of human suffering, according to the Buddhist teaching, is caused by living in a world of illusions or a false thinking or false mental habits. And so, you know, the Buddha thought that the most therapeutic thing people could do, would be to get in touch with reality. You know, this is really important. So the Buddha did say, if you read, say, the early sutras, the Buddha really does say that this is wholesome. He said, you know, doing meditation is wholesome. It's healing. And it has all of these therapeutic properties. But he also said it has those qualities because it's getting you closer to the truth, closer to reality. And when you, if you read some of the early sutras, the Buddha often talks about how we're not able to get in touch with the real world. You know, the reality is actually very hard to get in touch with because we have all of these thoughts and all of these emotional responses and all of these projections that keep us from getting in touch with reality. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, you know. I recently had to deal with a branch of the English department, a branch of the writing program, where there was all this internal conflict, all of this unhappiness. And the person in charge had really very much alienated many of the people who worked for her. And finally, they called me up on the phone and said, you know, we're so unhappy, you've got to come over here and intervene. So I had to go over to this office and basically meet with all the employees in the office. And then I had to talk to the boss. And I met with all the employees, and all the employees said the same thing, you know, this person is very hard to work with, she's very critical. She always puts us down. She's angry at us. She yells. Sometimes yells at us. And I met with 10 different people, and they all pretty much said the same thing. They said, you know, this person is mean to us. She yells at us. She's very impatient. And I listened to them all very carefully. You know, I also had a chance to talk to the boss. And the boss had a totally different picture. Now, it was amazing to me, you know. The boss, when I asked the boss to describe her office, she said, "We're like a family. We all love each other, and we get along so well." And she said, "This place runs on love." I'm not making this up. You know, it sounds like something I'm making up to make a point, but it's really true, I swear. You know, you're supposed to tell the truth, you know, by the way, you know, in Buddhism, that's actually so, you know, and I'm telling you 100% the truth. And you know, I was struck by this, right? How all the employees said, "My boss is a tyrant, and she's hypercritical, and we can never please her." And when I talked to her, she had this image of the place as being, she said, "This place runs on love." She said, "You know, we all are like a family," right? So it was like a dysfunctional family. But this is an example of how, you know, perception can be quite different from reality, quite different from reality. And I'm not a therapist, and I'm not a organizational specialist, so I wasn't in a position to mediate between the boss and her workers and get them all to get to a different place. You know, a really skillful mediator would come in and show the boss that the workers didn't see things her way, and so on, you know. But the boss really wasn't actually ready to change very much. So basically she's retiring, which is probably a good thing. Has been in the job too long, and so on. But You know, this was an example of how people can have very, very distorted perceptions of reality. And you know, the Buddha talked about how our perceptions of reality can be very far from reality. And so, you know, he said, at times in the sutras, he compares meditation practice. He said, you know, if you sit down on the cushion and you work with your mind and you calm the mind, when the mind is in this state of calm, which is called shamatha, S-H-A-M-A-T-A, or S-H-A-M-A-T-H-A. It looks like shamatha, okay? Shamatha. When you can get into this very calm, relaxed state, you no longer feel threatened by your surroundings, you can take another look around and you can see things a little differently. See, so when we sit down on the cushion, we're calming the mind and we're practicing shamatha. When you watch the breath, it generally has a calming effect, right? People come in for an evening meditation. They're stressed from the day. And they start watching the breath, and pretty soon their anxiety level really begins to drop, really begins to drop. And the theory is, in Buddhism, that, you know, if you're many people, when their anxiety level begins to drop at the end of the day, they go to sleep, basically, for a little while, and then they wake up, you know. But they're so stressed and tired that when their anxiety level drops, they just go to sleep. But if you keep watching the breath, eventually you sort of come back to life, and you're in a much calmer place. This is very typical of people who practice meditation. If you sit down on the cushion, if you do this regularly, after about 15 minutes, you have a deep relaxation response. It's actually predictable. About 15 or 20 minutes into your meditation, you'll have this deep relaxation response, and your anxiety level will go will really drop. Okay, that's sort of step one. And the theory is that if you can just not be so anxious, if you're not so fearful or angry or nervous, you know, you can get to this place where you can look at the world a little bit more calmly, right? And then maybe if you keep looking carefully, you'll begin to see things as they really are. See things as they really are. So this person, this manager, didn't practice Zen. And she probably, my impression of her is that she wanted to do a super good job. She was a hyper-perfectionist. And she pushed herself very, very hard. She would work like 18-hour days, and she would push herself so hard, and she would also push everyone around her very, very hard. She was really a hard, charging boss, right? And very successful for that reason. But, you know, she was so stressed out all the time and so anxious about not doing a good job that she couldn't notice that the people around her were suffering. You know, this is so common. She was in this sort of like cloud of fear and anxiety, and she was unable to perceive the responses of other people, which were, and frankly, they were afraid to be too open, but if she had been a little bit more aware, she would have noticed, she would have seen their faces, right? The anxiety on their faces. So shamatha, calming the mind, is a very important aspect of meditation practice. You get to a place where your conditioned responses of fear and anxiety are sort of less powerful. And you can begin to observe things for what they really are. And the Buddha talked about this as, he said, it's like looking into a pond, and when the water is really clear, you can see the stones, all the stones and the little fish at the bottom of the pond. We've all had this experience where if you look into water that's very, very clean and clear, you can see everything at the bottom of the pond. So step one is making the water clean and clear by relaxing the mind. And step two is shamatha is step one. vipassana, or looking. Looking is step two. So step one is calming the mind. Step two is observing reality. So if this manager had quieted her mind a little bit, she might have been able to notice that the people around her were very anxious, uneasy, and unhappy. See? So shamatha is calming the mind, and vipassana is looking. In Chinese, this is called stopping and seeing. Stopping and seeing. In Zen tradition, stopping and seeing. So that sounds good, right? That sounds great. We need to calm the mind. We need to clear away the fear and anxiety. We need to stop projecting and see things as they really are. Really get to reality. Reality. See? That would be great. But actually, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's more complicated than that. Let me go back to the koan for a minute. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is written, the mind is like an artist ceaselessly producing the five skandhas. In all the world, there is nothing that is not produced by the mind. See, now this is a little different twist, because, you know, you might have, if you know anything about Zen, if you read books about Zen, one of the things you might know is that, you know, Zen has this very strong association with the arts. You know, poetry, painting, sculpture, ceramics, you know, some of the greatest art in Asia, in East Asia, comes out of the Zen tradition. You know, it's interesting. And you might think, okay, well, that's nice. You know, Zen people like the arts. How nice. That's nice. You know, Zen people like art. Calligraphy. But people don't necessarily understand the significance of this. You know, what we call the arts are very important in Zen, but not for a trivial reason. See, the Buddha said, if you calm the mind and you perform, you observe the world, you can see things as they really are. Sounds like a simple proposition. But it's more complicated because, basically, you know, it's very difficult to see things the way they really are. The story about looking into the pond makes it all sound so simple, but it's actually very complicated. Let me explain a little bit, or try to explain. You know, I was reading something about a year ago from biology. And in biology, there is this theory of what's called, this word is a very strange word, it's called Umwelt, U-M-W-E-L-T, it's a German word, Umwelt. And biologists say each kind of creature lives in its own Umwelt. So for example, you know, a fly lives in a fly universe, you know? It's really, you know, the fly lives in a fly world, see? So, you know, a fly doesn't see things the same way as a bird, you know? Fly has like 1,000 eyes. It has sticky feet, you know? A fly has actually feet that stick to things. It has multiple legs. I forget how many legs it has. It has wings. It flies around. So, you know, the fly's world is the world the fly lives in is very distinctive. It's the fly's world is a fly's world. It's not a bird's world. And the fly's reality is absolutely, seems very real to the fly, see? There's things flies understand and things flies don't understand. Now, they were saying that the fly has its own Umwelt, its own world. And the spider has its own Umwelt, see? And the spider's Umwelt is totally different from the fly's Umwelt. I hope this isn't driving you crazy, but it's actually very interesting, right? It's not like fly and spider live in the same world. They both structure their worlds in very different ways. The fly's world is built around the fly's body, its thousand eyes, its sticky feet, its being a flying creature. It can smell things, right? Spiders can't smell anything. They don't have eyes like really good eyes like a fly. They have very bad eyesight, you know. And they create webs, as you know. And you know what? Flies can't see webs at all. They don't understand webs at all. So spider's umwelt makes no sense to the fly. Isn't this fascinating? I think this is fascinating. See, you know, you can see this in action in many different ways. You know, my wife is quite an avid bird watcher, and she's very avid in bird conservation, you know. And birds occasionally hit our back window. And if you are around buildings that have a lot of plate glass windows, if you care to look, if you dare to look, there'll be all these dead birds in migratory season at the base of the window. Birds cannot understand glass. See, if you could take a bird and you could bring it up to the glass and you could peck at say peck it with your beak, it wouldn't help. See, because the bird's umwelt can't make sense of glass. See, that's interesting, right? No matter what you do to try to educate a bird about glass, it's never going to figure it out. It's not that the bird is stupid. We could say, oh, birds are so stupid, unlike us. But see, we have our own umwelt, see? We see things and we don't see things, right? The same thing with deer, right? How many deer have to get hit by cars before the deer will learn not to step out in front of a car, right? They must be so stupid, right? But it's not that. Their umwelt can't make sense of cars. They can't figure it. Now look, we have umwelts too, right? We're heating up the planet. Lots of people think, oh, I love this warm weather, or look, it's snowing, it can't be heating up. And you can say, what's wrong with these humans? But it's our umwelt, right? Okay. So see, this is very close to Buddhist thinking. This is so close. I mean, I go around all day just looking for things that look like Buddhism. That's my umwelt. So when I read something and think, oh, this is just like Buddhism, I put a marker in it and take it home, right? The average person thinks he or she is in touch with reality. Nothing is simpler than being in touch with reality. Of course, you know. I know what reality is. Come on. I've got an alarm clock on the table. It's set for 7 a.m. I get up. I go to my job. I push paper or I deliver packages. I come home. I have a drink. I have dinner. That's reality, right? That's how people think. But, you know, that's actually not reality. You know, so much of what humans do is just highly symbolic. And it has, you know... If you know anthropology, if you've ever taken an anthropology course, you know, you go to other cultures and they have totally different value systems. Just totally different ways of behaving and interacting. And you suddenly realize, like, wait, what is the reality here? See? So, you know, Japanese, when my teacher Genki Roshi first came to the United States, he came from a Japanese background, very traditional temple background. My first teacher was a war orphan who was adopted by one of the most distinguished Zen masters in 20th century Zen, a man named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And my teacher was a little boy growing up in a Zen monastery, and it really made him a strange person, right? He should have been playing, he should have been doing other things. Instead, he was living like a little monk. But he came to the United States, and for a while I was his attendant, and When he was by himself, he was like a 17th century Japanese person. I'm not kidding. You know, he had a room with tatamis, straw mats on the floor, and he would sit there in his, you know, sit there in his robes with his little fan. You know, he'd be fanning himself. He'd have his calligraphy stuff out, and he'd be doing calligraphy, or he loved to calligraphy, Zen arts, or he'd be reading a book of poetry. I'm not kidding. You know, this guy landed in the United States in the middle of the hippie period, right? And he started a Zen center in Seattle with all of these people who were like in hippies, right? And they were sleeping with each other, smoking dope, it blew his mind. He used to make jokes about it. He said he would go into the bathroom. We had a house where everybody lived, and he would go into the bathroom, and there would be like an unfinished sandwich in the bathroom, and a cup of coffee. Next to the toilet. You know, this would just blow him away. You know, he would say, you know, when you eat, you should eat. You know, and then when you have to go to the bathroom, go to the bathroom, but don't eat in the bathroom, right? It really was like a mind blower. There were so many aspects of our behavior. It was just a culture shock, right? Because his Umwelt was so different from our Umwelt. So, you know, the truth is, if you say, well, you know, one way to look at it is to say that Americans are totally wrong and the Japanese understand reality, right? Another way to look at it is to say, well, the Japanese are totally wrong and we're the ones who are in touch with reality. But you see, I mean, that's clearly not, that's absurd, right? I mean, in many ways, reality is something that's created. It's created, you know. The person who thinks that the 9-to-5 American life is reality is living in a kind of dream. And he needs to go to, Fiji or live with the Inuit for a while and realize that all of this is a kind of collective dream. Now look, if we don't eat, we die. That is definitely so, you know. But what we call food is very much something what we call eating is very much something we create, you know. So, you know, one way to think about it is that there are many, you know, the fly is not living in a dream world or a fantasy world. It's living in a world that's 100% real, but it's just a fly's reality. It selects things and it can't include other things. Yeah? And the spider lives in its reality, and it's not living in a dream world, really. It's selected some things and it's neglected others, right? So, you know, the fly is in touch with the reality, but it's not in touch with the spider's reality. And so the fly flies right into the web, and it doesn't even know what a web is and can't figure it out, and it can't learn. And a deer is in its reality. It's not in a dream world. It's just in its own Umwelt. And it just, they keep walking out onto 287 and getting hit by cars. You know, so... this is a different way of looking at things, yeah? This is very close to the Zen way of thinking about things, you know? It would be nice if you said, okay, sit down on the cushion. Sit down on the cushion, calm your mind, and see things as they really are. And there is a truth to that. That's sort of like elementary Buddhism. That's like elementary Buddhism, Buddhism 101. Sit down on the cushion, calm your mind, look into the pond and see things the way they really are. And sometimes it's like that, right? Sometimes it's like that. So, you know, I've been married for a long time, 37 years. I got married when I was 22 years old, and I was a very immature person. Now I'm a little less immature. So, you know, sometimes if my wife and I have a disagreement, you know, I feel I'm right, you know, and she's not right. And I'll go upstairs and I'll eventually get to my cushion and I'll meditate and then I'll realize, gee, you know, I wasn't patient, I wasn't kind. And I realized, you know, I was caught up in my own ego. I was too defensive. I wasn't really being the best person I can be. See, so sometimes that works. That's definitely a good way to get in touch with reality. So living in illusion, sit down on the cushion, get closer to the truth. Okay, that's a wonderful aspect of Zen practice. But you know, on a deeper level, reality isn't that simple. It isn't that simple. There's really no one right way to live. There's no one right way to live. So this makes life very complicated in a certain way. How does the koan put it? The mind is like an artist ceaselessly producing the five skandhas. Now, you know, just so you know, in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist theories of the mind, these skandhas are sort of like aspects of consciousness. So, you know, you could just say they're aspects of consciousness, you know. So the way we experience the world, the way we perceive, is something we're actually creating. You know, we're creating our own reality, and there isn't one reality. There isn't one reality. In Zen tradition, you know, people really believe this. There isn't one reality. You know, scientists think they have the reality, but with Zen people say, no, that's just another Umwelt. And actually, not only do different creatures have different Umwelts, different realities, but actually people, different civilizations have different Umwelts, you know, and actually different individuals have different. Your Umwelt's a little different from my Umwelt, you know, it just is. So, you know, this puts us in kind of a dilemma, right? How are we supposed to live? Now, how are we supposed to live? Well, let me in some traditional religions, there's this idea, right? The idea that there was a creator who made reality, right? So, in the Bible, for example, in the first book of the Bible, God creates the world. There was no, you know, God creates the world and it's created. So there was nothing. And in the beginning, God said light, and there was light, and so on for 6 days. And on the seventh day, everything was done, and God could rest. So, you know, this says the world has already been created. It's already finished. And this is a beautiful story. You know, Buddhism doesn't have such a story. You know, doesn't have such a story. Buddhism has a different view. So, you know, if you ever go to Nepal, and you go to Kathmandu, there's a famous temple up on the hill, up outside of Kathmandu. It's called Svayambhunath. You've probably seen pictures of it. Svayambhunath. Svayambhunath. And if you ever see pictures of Buddhist temples in Nepal, it's up on a hill and it's got it's got eyes painted on it. The famous Buddhist stupa with eyes painted on it. And pilgrims go up there all the time to see this temple, and they come down and they say, "I've been to," and hippies used to go and say, "I've been to Svayambhunath." But if you say, "What does Svayambhu mean?" they don't know. They just know it's a temple in Nepal. But, you know, Svayambhu means self-creating. Self-creating. So in Buddhism, there isn't a creator. Or let me take that back. Would you like to know who the creator is in Buddhism? Yes. The creator is you. See, the universe is self-creating all the time. See, the universe is self-creating. Universe is developing over time, creating itself. And you, as part of the universe, are creating the universe, see? creating. Who is the creator? You are. We're all the creators of reality. And there isn't some reality that's already fixed and finished. It's unfolding all the time. See? And actually, this is a wonderful idea, but if you think about it, it puts a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. Because it's really saying, look, do you want the universe to be a nice place? Yes. Then you have to help to make it a nice place. Because the universe will be what you help to create it to be. I hope I'm making some sense. There was a writer named Norman Mailer. I don't know if you know Norman Mailer, his work. Most people don't read him anymore. He's gone out of style. But, he was a very celebrated writer in the 1960s, and he was raised in a Jewish tradition, but he was not a very serious Jew. Once he stabbed his wife with a penknife, actually, and had to be arrested by the police. So, he's a mixed bag, right? He had a good writer, but you wouldn't want to be married to him. But toward the end of his life, he actually started thinking about some of these issues. And he wrote a book, and in the book he said, maybe God doesn't have complete control of things. You know, maybe God really could fail. And he said, maybe God needs our help, see. And I think that's a very beautiful idea. Maybe God needs our help, see. So a Buddhist view is a little bit like that. A Buddhist view says everything is God. Everything is sacred. Everything is alive. You are the creator. I am the creator. It's all one big life, see. How we create our, since there is no one way to live, how we create our world is contributing to how the whole universe is getting created. This sounds very grand, but what it really means is that, you can't make excuses for your life by saying, oh, it's just reality. See, you can't make excuses for the way things are by saying it's just reality. You know, the teaching of Zen is that there isn't one fixed reality. You have to take responsibility for your own life. You have to take responsibility for your own consciousness. See? So, when you're angry, you sit down on the cushion and you make yourself calmer and you see the sources of your anger and you feel compassion instead of anger. See? This is very important. You have chosen that path. You've made it happen, right? You're a better person, and the world is a better place, see. Now, you could be angry. You know, you could live your life in anger. That's a possibility. That's a reality, too, the life lived in anger. But, in Zen, we really believe that life requires us to be creative and active. See, creative and active. There's no such thing as here's your life, take it. See, there's no such thing as that. Life isn't finished. It's not a package that's been handed to you. It's something you have to create yourself. So we all have to be like artists of our own life or artists of our own mind. See, and this is not a metaphor. Actually, this is literally true, we Zen people are like artists of consciousness. We create a beautiful mind. We create a beautiful life. And by creating a beautiful life, we create a more beautiful world. See? This is how Zen people think. It might sound nuts, but this is how they think. You can live in an umwelt of fear and hatred. Or you can work on yourself, you can recreate your mind, you literally recreate your world and make it a kind of, a paradise, make it a paradise. I have met people in my life who were great artists of consciousness, I actually think some of my teachers were like great artists of consciousness. They had made a beautiful world, you know, beautiful. Many years ago, this is like 30-some years ago, the Dalai Lama came to our Zen center. He knew my second teacher, Webb. And this was before the Dalai Lama was such a big rock star, you know. He would go to a little Zen center in Seattle. He was in Seattle, and he did give a talk at the University of Washington that was hugely well attended. But then he came over to our Zen center and sat with us and had dinner and so on. But, you know, he is contagiously a nice person, and he is nice to be around because he has created a beautiful consciousness, yeah? And it inspires other people to try to live a beautiful life, you know, a beautiful life. So this idea that, you know, reality isn't fixed, that there's no one way to live, could be very terrifying, right? It could be frightening, because it means, which way of life will I choose, right? And Zen says, you know, there's no Umwelt that is your Umwelt, right? The spider has its Umwelt, and the fly has its Umwelt, but your Umwelt you will have to create for yourself, yeah? And there isn't a creator who's going to tell you what to do. You know, you have to go through the process of trying to figure this out for yourself. So it's a big responsibility. But you know, when you cultivate calmness, you can see things more clearly. And you know, when you can see things more clearly, you really do respond to the world more compassionately, more kindly. Yeah. And, you know, I think we do have a kind of a deep hunger, sort of like there is probably something in our character or in our nature which really loves kindness. You know, really, I mean, the Buddhist teaching is, and the Zen teaching is that, you know, if you go, the human being is like an onion, right? You know, when we meditate, we're taking off the skin of the onion, the rough skin, and then we're taking off the first layer. Then we're taking off the next layer, really. The mind is like an onion, you know. The self is like an onion. The top layer is this rough exterior. We cut that off. Then there's another layer. We cut that off. You know, meditation is like taking the layers away from the onion. When you get to the center of the onion, there's nothing there. But when there's nothing there, you know, interestingly, humans have this explosion of compassion. This is very deep teaching. You know, many, many years ago, there was a Buddhist university in India. It was called Nalanda University. It's the first university in the world. And it used to admit women as well as men. It was eventually destroyed by a foreign invasion in the 12th century. And archaeologists were going through this great Buddhist university. And they found a little statue of the Buddha, and the statue had a little inscription, and it said, "Seeing emptiness, he feels compassion." Seeing, you should, if you couldn't remember anything else about Zen or about Buddhism, if you could just remember that statement, "Seeing emptiness, he feels compassion." Seeing emptiness, she feels compassion. That's the essence of Buddhism. Essence of Buddhism. So, you know, when we sit, we start peeling away the layers of the onion, you know, we get to that empty core, there's this incredible, like, explosion of compassion, which is what we mean in Buddhism when we talk about enlightenment. That's what we mean when we talk about enlightenment. And if you keep practicing, you will experience enlightenment for yourself, definitely. So we try to use compassion as our guide in creating our Umwelt, our personal Umwelt. And, your Umwelt is going to be different from mine. You know, some of us like to read detective novels and some of us don't. And that's okay. Some of us like to go to museums, and some of us hate that. But all the same, you know, we can all cultivate this beautiful life. And the way we can cultivate a beautiful life is by constantly clearing away our obstacles on the cushion. Cultivating quiet mind, shamatha, practicing vipassana, looking, inquiring. And living in a way that produces calm, compassion, kindness, trust. So the koan is the Avatamsaka Sutra's simile of the mind. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is written, the mind is like an artist, ceaselessly producing the five skandhas. In all the world, there is nothing that is not produced by the mind. So one other way to look at this is, you know, if your experience of consciousness is actually constantly being recreated. If you practice Zen for a while, if you follow the breath for a while, you're eventually going to notice something that's very curious, right? Very curious. It'll happen to you, I guarantee it. But if you meditate regularly for a while, you're going to notice that you'll be sitting on the cushion one day, you'll notice that reality, so to speak, is not continuous, right? We have a moment-by-moment awareness. Awareness comes in this little package. It's like you're aware of this moment, and then you're aware of this moment, and then you're aware of this moment. And we can actually, you know, actually only be aware of one moment at a time. This is if you meditate, you'll see this for yourself. You know, you hear a noise, and then you feel something in your leg, and then something else happens. But you have a perception, a perception, a perception. And when you start meditating at first, you have so many thoughts you can't watch the mind. But if you keep working with your meditation practice, eventually you'll have fewer thoughts, and you can observe the breath and your awareness of the breath with more care and detail. And you'll eventually notice that you have a sense impression or a moment of awareness, moment of awareness, moment of awareness. And in between those moments of awareness, there's actually like little empty spaces, I promise you. So there's a moment of awareness, emptiness, moment of awareness, emptiness, moment of awareness, emptiness. And believe it or not, the Buddhist view is that your unconscious mind is weaving your conscious experience is like a loom. You know, the human being or awareness is basically made up of these threads that are woven together moment by moment. Unconsciously, we're creating the world we experience consciously. Like a womb, like like the warp and weft of a loom. Okay, it's like the mind is often compared to a loom. It's weaving this moment of consciousness, and weaving the next moment of consciousness. So stay tuned. I would say if you do meditation regularly, that will happen to you, pretty dependably. So, please be the artist of your own consciousness. Please be the artist of your own life. And please be guided by your compassion as you create that life.